This episode of Working Lunch is fueled by Kabuki Sushi. Mr. Coley, local sushi place in Orlando, Florida, was a finalist for James Beard Award for Best Chef for Henry Mosso. He did not make the final cut, but you're a sushi lover. You like all kinds of food. You're big into sushi, aren't you?
Yeah, I was big into sushi, and we've eaten there many times prior to children. And now, like, once every 6 months, we get to have sushi. But, yeah, it's not... I don't know a lot of kids that are... You don't see kids in a sushi joint. It's not really a much of a thing. So that's put a cramp in our sushi style. But, yeah, no, there's a lot of good sushi joints in Orlando, and that's one of the better ones.
We used to take my kids to sushi. What is your go-to sushi? What does Franklin Coley get at a sushi place?
So I like the elaborate, you know. Once upon a time I went with the sashimi, but I like the more elaborate, like the TNT or the dynamite. I like the soft shell crab with the sauce over the top and the whole, you know, the involved things. That's going to be on my list. And then for my simple item, I almost always go with the sweet potato roll. Don't sleep on it. It's easy to pass it over, but it's like a good palate cleanser. It's like, it's a go-to for me.
You know what my go-to is at sushi?
What's that?
Absolutely nothing. I can't stand sushi. I don't like raw fish. No.
It's one of those things you're either in or you're not.
Oh, I am not in. No row for Joe. That's my rule on sushi, man. I just do not like sushi.
Well, the sushi joint in Korean has a whole Korean menu as well. So you can get like the bento box and that whole thing. So that's a good compromise for the sushi lover that wants to have something that a whole separate part of the menu for, you know, people that ruin the whole experience like you. You got something you can order off of there.
Yeah, like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something on the kids' menu. Franklin, James Beard in the news the last week or so about kind of, instead of handing out awards, doing more investigations on restaurants, kind of auditing them to see if they're kind of compliant with the, you know, left of center ecosphere. What's going on, James Beard?
Here's your headline from the New York Post, Joe. The James Beard Foundation now, quote, interrogates its award nominees. So, you know, given what is going to happen with some high-profile chefs in the era of Me Too and other revelations, James Beard apparently is putting, you know, potential candidates, potential awardees through the ringer a little bit. I'm going to quote directly out of the story that Sam Four received a scary phone call, quote, from a private investigator working for the James Beard Foundation, investigating potential awardees to make sure that they match the code of ethics. It goes on further to say that this person was interrogated over some social media posts, ultimately found, I'm going to just quote it here, the finding was that the nomination could go through because, quote, it did not find it more likely than not that you violated the foundation's code of ethics, end quote. So, yeah, they're tightening up the ship over there. I don't know how many restaurateurs are gonna fare in this new world, but James Beard is taking their vetting seriously these days.
I've worked in a few restaurants in my time, and you know, there's some Boy Scouts out there, but there's some not Boy Scouts. So I guess no matter how well you cook, you're still going to be judged by the James Beard Foundation. So everybody's in the moment of, you know, no scandals. So congrats to our local Orlando sushi restaurant, Franklin. Maybe you and your family can go celebrate with them for his nomination to James Beard Award. And on that tasty note, let's do the show.
May I help you? We need to talk about your flair.
I think I'm going to have to go super side.
I'm proud to be a bartender. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
We need a political revolution.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Come on, man.
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
From the home office of Align Public Strategies in downtown Orlando, Florida, this is Working Lunch. Coming up on the podcast, sectoral bargaining has come to Minnesota. In the nursing home space specifically, but all employers should be watching. It's not the industry you're in that's important, it's the process. We'll discuss how intentionally the labor community is leveraging independent standards boards as a way to force collective action.
And we'll discuss the steps that companies are increasingly taking to manage their reputational exposure on ESG issues and analyze the risks. We'll discuss those issues and wrap it up with the legislative scorecard.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. I'm Joe Kefauver, along with my aligned public strategies partner, Franklin Coley. And Mr. Coley, a lot going on this week, but let's kind of go up to Minnesota and talk about another kind of wage standards board, basically a very targeted, almost FAST Act-like action in Minneapolis regarding nursing home workers. We talked last week about the worker standards board in Detroit for those sports venues workers. Now we've got one next door in Minnesota. What's going on in this space?
I thought you were going to lean into your Minnesota accent there. You teased it, but then you pumped the brakes.
Whoa, up in Minnesota. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. So we keep paying attention to these FAST Act copycats. And meanwhile, you know, the labor community, and specifically in this case in Minnesota, the SEIU, continue to advance the broader concept of sectoral bargaining in a bunch of different areas. And we've talked about it in the rideshare, and we've talked about it in other spaces. But this is a significant victory and a significant milestone in Minnesota that essentially sets up a sectorial bargaining regime, a labor standards board that is very similar to what was established or what would have been, what may be established in California under the FAST Act. So under this, you essentially, it'll be very familiar. You essentially have three employers represented, three employees, and then a bunch of political appointees in the board. They're going to dictate wages and working conditions within the nursing home sector in Minnesota, which is obviously a sector in which, you know, the SEIU has a couple bases of support in the country. One is the janitorial, you know, that's where a lot of SEIU members come from. The others, home-based healthcare, and then healthcare more broadly, hospitals, nursing homes, et cetera. Those are like the bases that the SEIU kind of operates. They organize a lot of workers in a lot of places, but that's the bulk of their membership. And so, Joe, that's what happened this month. Just a couple weeks ago, this thing is now headed into law and will create a new kind of laboratory for the SEIU to test out this sectoral bargaining approach.
It's super interesting how they've been very patient, methodical, just taking little pieces of the workforce, little piece here, a little piece here, and changing the overall dynamics. If, you know, maybe I'll go be a worker in a nursing home as an orderly instead of an assistant manager at a restaurant. And maybe I have a better wage and benefit situation. So we're competing as an industry against this stuff. Franklin, last week we talked about Michigan and because of Michigan's, you know, existing preemption language, how there's likely litigation because of what Detroit's doing on this worker standards board that violate the state preemption. Is there any way, like, down the road in preemption states, you know, let's say Macon, Georgia wanted to do something like this, okay, and Georgia's got a preemption. Is there any way to make it pseudo voluntary in a way that, like, gets around state preemption laws? What's the fight going to look like when the unions are trying to do this in municipalities that have preemption laws?
Yeah, Atlanta, Georgia, theoretically could have this worker standards board, convene it, uses a platform to make recommendations to the city of Atlanta, which may or may not be able to act on it, but, you know, it becomes a platform to kind of drive this conversation. And, you know, where there's strong preemptions in place, most of this stuff is going to be preempted at the state level, and there's a whole process there. You know, potentially in some states, and you can do this in Georgia, Joe, but, you know, in some states you could potentially run a ballot initiative that set up some sort of regime like this within the state. But let me go back to Michigan let me flag this article right now before I start reading out of it, because you need to go read this. It's a Fast Company article. It's called "The Future of Worker Power Can Be Found in Minnesota." And Joe, it cites a couple other examples, I think, that have flown under the radar. You mentioned Michigan. there's a council there that this article references that's been established for nursing home workers. In Nevada, there's a similar one for home health care workers. In Colorado, they have just passed a standards board for home health aides, and one is under consideration in California. Now, we usually don't pay attention to this space. Most of the employer community does not pay attention to the home health care space, because what often happens there is, you know, in home health care, a lot of the times it's a family member, someone that's close, is getting paid by, you know, a government program, you know, Medicare or something like that. So it's not something that the employer community tends to watch closely, but those are a lot of SEIU members. And so in these states, kind of under the radar, and Minnesota's building upon all these little trial programs in these other states, we have these programs that are being stood up and tested and operated. And to your point, Joe, you know, what does it mean in these states when we have a FAST Act-like proposal under discussion in, let's call it, Michigan? You know, part of our messaging, and a very legitimate part of our messaging, is that, you know, nobody's done this before. This is foreign to our political culture. This is foreign to our political system. This doesn't make sense. This is not how representative policymaking works in this country. The challenge we're going to have in some of these jurisdictions, like Michigan, is they're going to go, what are you talking about? We've been doing this for years now with nursing home workers, and we've had this in Detroit. And so they're building these case studies in states across the country. These are, albeit on a smaller scale, but they're test driving how this model would work so they can point to it to state lawmakers and say, look, we have examples of this working here in this state. This is not a crazy out of left field concept from some random Western European country. This can work. And I think that's a challenge here. The employer community has got to start pushing back on some of this stuff in kind of an organized national way. I know the U.S. Chamber has been doing some stuff, putting out some papers, but I think by and large, the employer community is missing the boat on this and is a little bit asleep at the switch on this one. And one last thing, Joe, before we wrap it up, I'll point to another part of this article. Yet again, go read the article. The future of worker power can be found in Minnesota. But there's one section here that should send shivers down the spine. It says, I'm just going to read it, and it's talking about health and personal care workers. They frequently work either for an individual patient or for small agencies. In a, quote, fissured economy, as Madeline puts it, with lots of small employers, franchisees, or independent contractors, it's difficult or impossible to unionize in the traditional way. A standards board, though, creates a path toward collective action. So whether we're paying attention or not, the other side knows what they're doing here. They know how this new law in Minnesota resembles the FAST Act and is going to resemble the FAST Act that we're dealing with next year in, you name it, Illinois or New York or wherever it may be. So this is not accidental. This is not coincidental. This is very strategic, and it's something that everyone should pay attention to.
Well said. Good counsel. That's a great catch to pull out that last line, that a standards board creates a path toward collective action. And so that should be the takeaway from that segment for operators. Mr. Cole, interesting article this week. You cited an article about Minnesota in the last segment, citing an article in this segment. In the Wall Street Journal, it was June the 6th. It's entitled, Companies That Embrace Social Issues Have Second Thoughts. And it cites kind of almost a internal process that some companies are going to kind of, I don't know, make a scorecard, make some kind of an analysis of impacts both internally and externally for getting involved in some of these issues. Can you talk a little bit about what companies are doing in this, what this article talks about companies are doing in this kind of new world order of the DEI environment?
Yeah, this one little piece was super interesting to me, and it's a good article. It's worth a read. We put in midnight reads, you know, go to our site and subscribe to our daily little newsletter and you'll get it. But in this, PPG Industries, which is like Glidden Paint, some other things, I'm just going to read out of here, uses an internal scoring system to determine if and when it makes sense for the company to comment on matters that may offend some of its customers and employees or affect its brands. Senior leaders, including representatives from the legal department and human resources, meet regularly to discuss the pros and cons of taking a position, You know, I know that all brands are doing, you know, polling and looking at tons of data on a regular basis, public opinion polls, in addition to, you know, the marketing team looking at the consumer side. One, I was impressed by this. And two, this scares the bejesus out of me as well, because so much of this stuff moves so quickly. And, you know, elected officials in particular that command a large audience can move the needle on issues so quickly that being too married to kind of an algorithm, a scoring system, could really get you off track. I think you need that human element around. So it impressed me for two reasons. One, I think it's really great and really cool, and it's a really great approach to provide some guidepost. But also, on the flip side, being too married to it could potentially be a huge problem for brands. I think you need that human element around that table saying, yeah, I hear you on that, but here's, you know, people that watch this stuff day in, day out, that can provide that kind of context and maybe lost in the numbers day to day or week to week.
There's a interesting, they cite another company and the CEO of that company, excuse me, that, you know, they go through a basic triage process, you know, and ask themselves a bunch of questions. How central is this topic to our business, to our customers, to our employees? Does it really concern them? Would they expect us to be opining on this because it intersects with their day-to-day lives? And they just kind of walk through this litmus test of, you know, it seems very common sense, but I think a lot of people kind of just react and jump in and just don't take the time to walk through. Does it really matter? Does it moving the needle, you know? And of course, you and I are biased. I'm particularly biased that really the three most important audiences a company has to worry about are its employees. And if it's not a big deal to the employees, it probably gives you your answer right there. But it is interesting that companies are now starting to be a little less reactionary and a little more methodical in this space.
Another piece that we ran in Midnight Reads this week too, Joe, was, I think it was on the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal, but they did a roundup of college students and their thoughts on, you know, this whole Target Bud Light thing. And it was a diverse cross-section of obviously very smart college students that study this stuff. And they're like the target demographic for a lot of companies too. So, you know, they're not like us old beat around, you know, hands, and they have different, they're of the generation that has different expectations of companies, that they expect them to be more than, you know, flinging chicken. But at the same time, you know, the way in which they choose to engage or not to engage in these issues, and the way that these students kind of laid it out, I thought was really, really insightful. And a lot of the kind of letters to the editors, kind of how it was structured, struck right through these kind of meaningless marketing gimmicks. And they kind of characterize, I think, the Bud Light thing, at least a couple of them, as like a marketing gimmick that went bad. And, you know, if you're really going to be for LGBTQ rights, then there's a way to do it. And that was not the way to do it. And so, like, if you're going to determine that for your company, you need to like take a stand on this, then there are ways to do it that are like super meaningful. And, you know, so anyway, it was really interesting to see just younger minds, obviously very sharp younger minds in this space, kind of wrestling with it and advising companies, and they were advising them in different ways to think about it. But that's also worth another read, Joe, for our listeners. And I think it hit on some of the points you're hitting on in terms of companies need to find their true north. We've said it 100 times now. They need to find out what makes sense. What makes sense for their employees is always should be part of that, you know, and then you can start building out the other stakeholder groups from there. But, you know, you really have to think through these positions. You have to pressure test them. You need to take in polling, you know, I love the algorithm as kind of a guidepost to help guide that, and then have that triage system. All those are important facets, I think, of having the right positioning in the space.
It's time for the Legislative Scorecard, where we go around the country and update you on the latest legislative and regulatory developments. Mr. Kohler, let's start with wages. Some local action, both in greater Boulder, Colorado area, and in the city of Chicago.
Colorado, as we know, has this hinky local or a hinky state preemption that allows locals to raise their minimum wage. And so we've had a lot of Colorado cities playing footsie. Longmont is the latest. It's part of the Boulder County Consortium of Cities. That's very, very official sounding. And they're going to study, engage, and potentially enact a regional minimum wage across participating jurisdictions in Boulder County. The work group includes the county, the city of Boulder, Louisville. I don't know how they pronounce it in the mountains of Colorado, and Longmont. So those, you know, look, Cook County took a similar approach many years ago, where you could kind of opt in, opt out. It looks like that's potentially where the consortium of cities is going to head on this issue as well.
And then Chicago, the minimum wage is going up 40 cents in the city of Chicago as of July 1st. But that's not the most important thing. It's the Fair Workweek Scheduling Law going into effect July 1.
I was going to say, you're burying the lead there, Mr. Kefauver. Yeah, that we've seen when these laws go into effect, like in New York, like 6, 12, 2 years later, you know, Chipotle was one that sticks out in New York, just gets hammered. So July 1, we know these Fair Workweek ordinances are really tough to comply with. It will be important that everyone has their ducks in a row in Chicago. It's also worth mentioning, Joe, just while we're here, July 1 is the, you know, the perennial time, July 1 and January 1, when laws go into effect, where minimum wage, you hit automatic escalators and that sort of thing. So there's a whole bunch of minimum wages that are bumping up around the country, and there's a whole lot of new stuff that's going to be going. Their effective date was set for July 1. So July 1 every year is a big time for the compliance teams to button up.
Good counsel, my friend. I know that I think Connecticut went up June 1 and another state went up June 1, but you're right. The bulk of them seem to happen on July the 1st. So it's good note. Franklin, switching to paid leave, wasn't much activity in Maine this week on that paid leave bill that we've been watching up there. But in Pennsylvania, that bill took a little step along the process.
Yeah, made it out of a House committee. It's the 12 to 20 weeks of paid time. It's split employer-employee contribution, probably going nowhere, but it's continuing to work its way through the House.
And let's go back to California, Franklin. We haven't even mentioned California on this podcast yet. We're, you know, half an hour into it. But we did talk about it. Yeah. So, but we got some workplace violence prevention legislation that's working its way through the process as well that made its crossover deadline last week. Talking about, you know, violence in businesses and protecting workers and active shooting drills, kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal. And this is interesting. And, you know, in some ways, I will be interested to see how this conversation plays out, because, I mean, Starbucks and others have been making this a big issue nationally. Starbucks not the only one. A bunch of retailers have, including Walmarts of the world and some markets. But, you know, Starbucks, within the context of the labor organizing campaign, has been shutting down locations over this, saying that, you know, they've got to protect employees. So this is a growing kind of issue and area of conversation. This legislation is slightly different, but it's in the same space. Anyway, this would establish new workplace violence prevention standards. It would prohibit employers from maintaining policy that require employees to confront active shooters or suspected shoplifters. And it would also require, like, some active shooter trainings and other training programs. It's getting at this root issue, Joe, where there's increased kind of tension and potentially even violence within the workplace, and trying to put some protections that get workers out of the way of that. But it's interesting to see California get in this. This is a space that I think we're going to see more action and kind of driven by corporate action, but also in legislatures.
And Franklin, we've talked a little bit about captive audience lately, that the bill in New York got out of another committee this week, the Rules Committee, I believe.
Yeah, I thought this one was slowing down and kind of in the gutter, but it at least has some life because it advanced out of an Assembly Rules Committee. It would, as we know, captive audience prevents employers from coercing employees into participating in mandatory meetings. In this one, it's union organizing, political or religious matters. Moving up the Northeast into Maine, we also have had a captive audience bill there clear the process, and now is headed to the governor. So we continue to have activity in this space, Joe. It's an issue that I think we're going to see more of for a while.
And speaking of activity we've been seeing for a while, the union beat moves on this week. Collectivo Coffee and Barnes & Noble in the news this week.
That's right. Barnes & Noble's, what a blast from the past. I'm going to go to Barnes & Noble's this weekend. I've got to get my daughter some notebooks. So in New York, we have 30 workers have organized into a unit there. They've signed their authorization cards. And so that is in the process of moving towards a union election. And Collectivo, one of those, let's call it first wave independent coffee shops. At the time, it was the largest coffee chain in the U.S. to organize. That was weeks, barely months before the first Starbucks location in Buffalo. But they have won a contract. So that's a big deal. It was ratified by 95% of workers. And that's a big feather in the cap. That's an accomplishment for that local union, and certainly will be a talking point on the success of these efforts in the independent coffee segment.
Well, Franklin, we talked earlier about Chicago's new Fair Work Week scheduling law going into effect. Not to be outdone, their next door neighbors, Evanston, Illinois, who just last week or two was talking about a minimum wage increase and getting rid of tip credit. They said, hey, we want to play in this scheduling game too.
Yeah, I feel like we haven't had Evanston in the scorecard in a while, but I feel like they're a routine offender that they frequently, I mean, prior to the last couple of weeks, but I feel like over the past 5 or 10 years, they have a tendency to pop in here. So what they're looking at is 30 locations with at least 200 employees in aggregate. So does not include businesses with three or fewer locations in the city that are owned by one employer and operating under a franchise agreement. Bottom line is they're kind of targeting the big guys. And it looks like pretty standard elements of scheduling. So good faith estimate for the first 90 days, good faith estimates, average weekly hours, days, shifts, and 14-day advance notice, compensation for shift change, right of first refusal for additional hours before hiring more workers, and extensive record keeping. The second to last provision there, first right of refusal for additional hours before hiring more workers is typically one of the tougher issues to work around, but all these component parts are pretty standard at this point.
Yeah, they included everything and the kitchen sink. But what struck me most was the language around good faith estimates for new employees in terms of what days of the week, how many hours a week, what their shifts. I mean, kind of, not necessarily committing, but almost committing to that with a new hire. I thought was super, super interesting. Mr. Coley, alcohol to go, cocktails to go, success in Connecticut and Illinois.
Yep. On the way to the governor's desk in Connecticut, governor signed in Illinois, the cocktails are free. they can trot on out of that restaurant, jump in your car, head down the road.
That is something I never thought I'd see. I mean, I just, it's just so bonkers to me that you just walk out of an Outback with my, you know, my cup of wine or whatever it is. It just, to me, is, who would have thought we'd ever seen that? That's crazy stuff. Franklin, one thing we thought we'd see by now is the SEC's kind of carbon footprint rule that was, I guess the original rule was issued last year. The business community has overwhelmed the agency with comments, mostly negative on the proposals. And it looks like it's kind of, I don't want to say imploding under its own weight, but that race car seems to be slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, the proposed rule was released in March, over 10,000 comments. They're required by law to review all these comments and take them into consideration. We can argue over, and much litigation has in the past over, you know, how that process. But I think we can say that the SEC, at least on this, is being somewhat deliberative. And I think the trade group lobbyists would tell you the same, that they're trying to work here to take in consideration these unworkable elements in terms of like the scope three, and once you start getting out deep into the supply chain and like how difficult that is. So yeah, it looks like, Joe, it's being pushed off to maybe 2025. So that ain't going to probably slow down California and others that are, you know, picking up where the SEC is leaving off. But yeah, at least the federal regime looks like it's a little ways off at this point.
And Mr. Kohler, the last item, Berkeley, California. When's the last time on this podcast? It's been about a year since we used the term en banc. En banc. The city of Berkeley is protesting against that court decision, that appellate court decision a few weeks ago, siding with the California Restaurant Association, that Berkeley's ban on gas and gas appliances and new construction was preceded by federal law. Berkeley's fighting back.
Didn't we have the Supreme Court jump in on this or something? Like, it's, I don't know. Yeah. We got to have some lawyers come on and talk about this. I thought this was done. Berkeley, give it up, man. Come on. This does feel like a last gas kind of effort here, but you know, that's what Berkeley's in the business of. So we'll see how this plays out. We'll report out on it, but we probably do need to have some lawyers come on at some point and talk about this issue as well.
Always got to have the lawyers, but no, interesting. They set up they're requesting an 11 judge panel, all new judges. They want the entire Ninth Circuit to rehear this case, not just one judge or a 3-judge panel. They want the entire Ninth Circuit. So we shall see. It seems to be a Hail Mary, but we'll see if that happens.
Spend that taxpayer money, Berkeley. Yeah.
So good stuff. Good stuff. En banc is French for on the bench. So they want everybody on the bench to hear this case. So we'll be following that. And as always, we'll have another scorecard for you next week. Well, my friend, another week, another pod. One thing we haven't talked about in quite a long time on this podcast is politics and the presidential primary politics. Obviously, we have the whole zoo going on on the red team. But not to be outdone, there's a little bit of fracas on the blue team as well. One RFK Jr. entering the fray this week. What's going on out there in primary land?
Well, forget about Cornel West too on the left side.
Yeah, Professor West. Yeah, I forgot about that as well.
It's getting crazy, Joe. It's getting crazy. The Trump DeSantis back and forth is political theater at its highest level. Not necessarily, you know, policy, but political theater and the snapping back and forth day to day, the Twitter battles between staff and surrogates is something to behold. So it's going to be interesting to see how things play out. Old FC may be taking a week off sometime in the fall and packing his bags and hitting the ground in Iowa. So it's I'm starting to get the fever a little bit.
I got a feeling.
And there is an interesting little podcast. I can't remember. I think it was Post Reports. It may have been 538. I think it was Post Reports. But there's a legitimate effort underway to put a third party, like an independent, on the ballot. The Joe Lieberman Group what's it called? Third Way or whatever. No labels is legitimately trying to get ballot access in all in every state right now for an independent, and to be determined, you know, who that would be. But you can see, like, I don't know. There's a bunch of different folks floating around out there that have been batted around. If you have a Trump Biden matchup, you could see, this never happens, but we political pundits like to talk about this stuff because it's just fun to think about. But in a Trump Biden matchup where so many are their unfavorables are high on both sides, you could see potentially a third candidate drawing more vote and potentially being competitive. So anyway, that's what I got for you, Joe, on the presidential front right now. It's all the fun stuff.
A third candidate in the race really, really hurts President Biden for sure. You know, the Trump folks will, you know, no matter what, they've proven they will stay with him. So a third party candidate won't chisel away a lot of votes from him, but it sure could hurt Joe Biden and put Donald Trump right back in the White House. So, interesting times. You know, I wish they would at some point talk about, you know, issues and policy instead of just the food fight fracas that we have to listen to every day. But I know that's a pie in the sky naivete, Franklin. It makes you just smile at my naivete.
Indeed. It makes me grin ear to ear. Right. We're going to have some debates for certain, and it'll be a lot of theater, but there will be some policy that comes out of those conversations. So I'm looking forward to that. That starts in August. So it's on my calendar. I can't wait. It's going to be good.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this week. And we'll be talking to you next week. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and we'll talk to you then.